Hello, Hare Krishna. This is Dhanadhar Swami.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hi, bro. Thank you. Okay. We're on the... actually, there's two more sections, but we've... let's see.
Oh.
One second. Okay. Let's see how... Okay, we're on chapter 3 now, Mystic Powers. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Text 1. Desha Bandhas Chitasya Dharana. Concentration is the fixing of the mind in one place. Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Taksur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Sapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. I'm at the graciously being hosted by Shastra Das, one of the Sangha members at his very suitable hermitage. Okay. Desha Bandhas Chitasya Dharana. Concentration is the fixing of the mind in one place. Okay, I got it. Somehow, I'm trying. Each time you give class, you're in a different place, and this desk is a bit high. I can't see the page so clearly. I need to set this up in a better way. One second. Oh, okay, one second. Sorry, I should do this before. So we are in a new section, and. It's a little bit interesting we're going to discuss this because we're discussing Astanga Yoga. As you remember, and I think this is really the key point, that the dynamic of this whole process of yoga, yoga meaning meditation, meditative absorption. One second. So this level of meditative absorption, we've discussed this many, many times, it takes such a high level of purity. So we finished the second chapter, which is the practice to get to the practice of meditative absorption. The practice to purify ourselves to come to the level of this depth of meditation. As it says, and I forgot chapter, what is it, the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita? For those, you know, for the neophytes, work is the means, and, you know, when you get more advanced, cessation of work is the means. So there's two levels of yoga. There's dealing with the external senses, the first five processes, and then really internalizing oneself in meditation. Even in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it describes that karma and gyan, or the yoga of action and the yoga of analysis, are not two separate paths. They're one path at different stages. That before you can come to the point of gyan and the path of analysis, which is also the path of yoga, because the path of yoga is a path of renunciation. You're so concentrated and focused on one thing that you're renouncing everything else. And in that enables you to analyze the difference between the soul and the body. So gyan, yoga is part of the path of gyan. It's just a means to get to that analysis, that discriminative discernment that allows one to clearly distinguish between the soul and the body. So in a similar way, in this whole complete Ashtanga Yoga process, the first five angas are to enable you to get to the sixth anga, which is this dharana, this concentration of the mind. And this is really where the dynamics of detachment really be internally really begin to manifest fully. And that's why somehow, even though it's the same process, did you pick up that it's discussed in another chapter? The first five angas of Ashtanga Yoga, Yam, Niyam, Asana, Pranayam, Pratyahara, were discussed at the end of the second chapter. And the next three are being discussed, the final limbs are discussed here in the third chapter. Okay, so before we begin that part, let's just review what we've gone over so far. Well, obviously, asana, well, yam, niyam, moral restraints, moral observances, how you deal with others and how you deal with yourself, is the foundation of controlling the mind, which is what yoga means. First, you have to control the vrittis or fluctuations that make you exploit others. That's yam, then niyam. You have to control the fluctuations or thoughts that degrade yourself or that push you away from the types of observances you need to purify your mind. Then you have to become free from the dualities of the body, which bring the mind to the senses. I am cold. I am hot. I am tired. You can't do yoga when the whole purpose of yoga is the mind has to be detached from the senses. Because if the mind goes to the senses, then the senses will contact the sense objects in an unhealthy way and create more karma, which covers the pure goodness of the mind, which enables one to see the soul. The karma is covering. The karma is distorting this instrument of the mind. The vrittis based on karma are distorting the instrument of the mind that allows us to perceive the pure self, which is where yoga is heading. Yoga is heading to imbibe, to dwell in the pure self. The ultimate use of the mind is to be able to see the pure self clearly and understand what it is, different from the body. So asana is necessary, and anybody in any practice can take note how an unhealthy body distracts one, brings the consciousness external, puts one in the bodily conscious of life. Of course, a very advanced person whose heart is filled with love and devotion, he transcends the body at a higher stage. Okay. And then pranayama, then the relationship with the breath and the mind, and how controlling the breath once one is able to become detached from the body or become undisturbed by the body, then the practice of controlling the breath in a prescribed way, controlling the number of breaths, the lengths of the breath, the power of the breath, and the restraint of the breath, is scientifically a powerful process to control the mind. So these were all discussed, and the benefits of doing this discussed. And then it discussed pratyahara, that when you do this by pranayama and asana, and when the sattvic nature of the mind, the sattva, the nature of the mind manifests and the mind is subdued, then one can become prepared. This is just a general statement that by asana and pranayama, I'm commenting on 53, chapter 2. When the sattva, the goodness of the mind, is manifest and the mind is subdued by this pranayama, then one becomes prepared for meditation. Again, some sequential process. Sequential. It's built. Spiritual life is building blocks. Even in the meditations in the Bhagavatam, there's a progression of realizations one has to have. Wait, my God, how can I forget this? This is Atrasargas Visargas Jastitya Poshana Utaya Mandatara Utakanta Nirodha Muktiya Asaya. So there are different subjects of the Bhagavatam, and they're progressively studied. To know one, you have to know the preceding subject. To proceed, you have to know the subject you're studying. Same thing in any particular field of knowledge. You need to know addition before you know this, and then before you know algebra, you need to know calculus, whatever it is, how it proceeds. So here it's saying, because this says this will help you to get to this goal of concentration of the mind, because it's all about that. It's not about exercise. It's not about controlling the breath. It's about the concentration of the mind, which is yoga. But then he explains there's one more thing before the mind can actually come to this concentrated state. And that's a description of pratyahara, that the senses and the sense objects have to be detached. And this has to be accomplished through the control of the mind. And it describes, it gives a nice analogy of the mind. It's like a queen bee, where the queen bee, all the other bees go. So where your mind goes, then your senses will go. So if the if your mind focuses and concentrates on one particular, you know, in meditation, then the senses will become internalized. The senses will be subdued. And if the mind, the desires of the mind, are projected externally, then the consciousness will go out towards the senses. So, very, very difficult, and as Bhagavad Gita says, because if when you're focused on even one object of the senses, even a man of discrimination can get carried away. So that then the next stage is this, somehow this practice of pratyahara. Of course, you're still trying to concentrate, you're still meditating, but you haven't really become concentrated yet, but you're able to control the mind, focus it on an object of meditation, and as you're focusing on the object of meditation, then the mind has been withdrawn from the senses. And because the mind is withdrawn from the senses won't draw the awareness or the consciousness away from the soul into the world of illusion and attachment to the body and the mind. And then he concludes, just give me a roof last time, and from this, the highest control comes. The highest control is this pratyahara, when the mind is restrained and focused, because the senses are automatically under control. So obviously this is for yogis, and the process for yogis is complete detachment and aloofment from the objects of the senses. And so this is recommended because for a yogi and this yogic process, it's withdrawing the senses, which again points to the efficacy of kirtan, because in kirtan, even if the mind wanders to the senses, it won't go to the sense objects. When the mind wanders to the senses, it goes to the mantra. So this is the efficacy of, well, in traditional meditation, when you withdraw the senses, and then if you can't control yourself and the senses, the mind goes to the senses, then it will proceed to sense objects, drawing one into karmic fruit of consciousness. So here, in this yoga process, it's recommended complete withdrawal. Of course, path of bhakti is different in some ways, but especially in especially it's different in, it's not a process of renunciation, but dedication. It's rather than completely subduing the mind is transformed by impressions, samskaras of devotion and love. It's almost as, rather than just work on the mind to bring it to goodness so that one can perceive the soul, by worshiping the divine and developing devotion for the divine, the mind becomes molded in devotion, which is the nature of the soul. So this process is just complete vairagya renunciation. It's not a surprise because it's for yogis. And it was mentioned in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, who practices this? Someone who's in seclusion. Because there can't, you know, if you really want to be a yogi, there can't be any fluctuation. The mind can, it has to be so steady. It has to be concentrated as if you're at, like, if you're pouring ghee, then it's just flowing. The one thing is flowing after the other. It creates a contiguous stream. So real meditation has to be that way. It can't be distracted. And therefore, you can't be among the external objects of the senses that can bring the consciousness outward. So here it's recommended in this pratyahara is this detaching the mind completely from the senses by a meditative process. And remember, and it's right, you know, that one is not yet at the level of dharana. He's really not concentrated yet. He's in the process of concentration, which will begin when one's flow of meditation has at least come to the point where the consciousness is detached or flowing away from the senses. And the stories that are given, one in the Bhagavatam is quoted in the purport by Vigyan Bhikshu is Subari Muni. That he was meditating under the water, but he became distracted in his meditation, and then his senses looked at two fish copulating, which somehow or other brought very prominently to within his mind the samskaras, the impressions he had from his past life of sex life, and taken by surprise, the sexual samskaras were activated. You see, even by the slightest stimulus, that's what it's saying. Pratyahara, you have to withdraw. It's very difficult because even if the mind, the senses, and the mind follows the senses, catch on to one sense object, it can invoke impressions that awaken other impressions within the consciousness. Now, after all, why did he go under the water? He went under the water to meditate to not be distracted. There's people that meditate in caves, not be distracted. People meditate on mountains, not to be distracted. People go to the Himalayas, not to be distracted. They go to the middle of the jungle, not to be distracted. So they don't want to be in an area where objects of the senses can agitate their impressions or attachments to those objects. It's just like if you get a scholarly person and give them meditation beads and you put them in a library, then the desires to read books will overcome his desire to meditate for sure. Someone who's become accustomed to surfing the web and doing all this kind of stuff, if he does his meditation before the computer, certainly he'll be on Facebook, which I don't really know what it is yet, but I heard there's something like that. So this is an example from the Bhagavatam of that verse of the Bhagavad Gita. The senses are so agitating, Arjuna, that they forcibly carry away the mind, even a person who is struggling to control them. But a person who restrains all of them and remains fixed on me as the supreme with senses under control, steady knowledge. So when one meditates on Krishna, one meditates on Vishnu, one meditates on Ishvara, one meditates on the Paramatma, and has some bandha or relationship, then the consciousness will flow naturally away from the senses to the object of meditation. Not just by obligation or duty, but by attraction. So that's a little bit more powerful, and that's what Vigyan Bhikshu is trying to illustrate by this story of Subhabhar Muni, who just one object of the senses contacted, even in the water, some object of the senses that brought out the desires in his heart, which happened to be a bit powerful from the previous life. And although he had mastered lofty attainment in terms of pratyahara, he was disturbed again. And this is very, very apropos, a description of what happened to many great yogis that came from the West to America, who were yogis, very, very controlled, had mystic powers. There's many descriptions of them. I don't want to name names, but very prominent yogis. And then when all of a sudden they were away from the Himalayas and they were in America and surrounded by beautiful women who were their students and not used to that type of association, many or most of them had sexual improprieties. And Prabhupada, who was in the world for many years, so-called, but dedicating himself to Krishna, dedicating himself to God, there wasn't, you know, a remarkable thing, there wasn't a tinge of compromise in his control in relationship with the opposite sex. Because he was fixed in a relationship with the object of his meditation. And then Ramananda Saraswati gave the example of Sita from the Ramayana, who had the highest, she was a simple woman, but she had the highest sense control, because when Ravana captured her, because she had love for Ram, and he's so fixed on Ram, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Nama, Hare Nama. She was so fixed on Ram that she was immune to all the lures of a powerful, attractive demon, Ravana, who was trying to seduce her. So the more Ishwara-focused theologies of the theistic traditions, rather than trying to suppress the past samskaras, I'm reading, exclusively by one's own will and meditative process, and thus run the risk of past samskaras reacting, as with the case of Sobhari, the yogi instead saturates the mind with devotional samskaras related to thoughts directed to the divine form and activities of God Ishvara. This is a more theological, elaborate expansion of Pantanjali's Ishvara Pranida. So replace the samskaras with theistic ones. Okay, now one is at pratyahara. The mind is focused sufficiently on the object of meditation, and one has cultivated enough vairagya that the mind has now become detached from the senses, and then concentration is possible. The first stage of internal meditation is Dharana Dhyan Samadhi. So I'm going to read something more about this concentration. Again, stressing, it's a nice summary of the natural progression between one anga of astanga and the other. It says, in fact, we have seen a gradual progression from the external to the internal throughout. The yamas are the most external, prescribing relations with other beings. One doesn't inflict violence, lie, steal, sexually exploit, or covet. The possessions of others. The niyams deal more internally with one's own practices. So, but practice is still related to external elements, hygiene, contentment, one's situation. So it's still, you're controlling your mind. In relationship to external elements, either other people or either other allurements. And then asana focuses on the body, pranayama more internal still, and pratyaya continues this progression of internalization by going still deeper, by withdrawing the consciousness itself from the senses. So that's pratyahara. So this continuation, this progression of internalization is really what this yoga is about. So dharana, concentration, potentially states, involves fixing the mind on one place. So desha bandha. One second, something here I got stuck. Oh no. One second here, please. Okay, thank you. It's quoted from this dharana described in Mahabharata and in the Markandeya Purana, and how the mind meditates on the circle of the navel, the lotus of the heart, the tip of the nose, tip of the tongue, with different external objects. And again, although Patanjali does not, really focus on what particular object to meditate on, the commentators that follow him quote verses that recommend a theistic meditation on Vishnu on the grounds that since concentration requires an object, when you meditate on an object that's very beautiful and alluring, the form of the Lord, then one has no desire to think of nothing else, since nothing else can compete in that type of attractiveness. So the meditation becomes so pronounced. They're recommending here this concentration, because the object of your concentration is more beautiful than anything else, so you can't be lured away from it. So this type of meditation can become very powerful. And this would be described, this type of meditation. It's there in the Bhagavatam. We know that you meditate first on the lotus feet of the Lord and progress up his body and then come to the smiling face. So it says, a good illustration of this type of meditation, sagun, meditating with qualities. One should thus meditate on Hari, Vishnu's pleasing face, his beautiful lotus eyes, his gorgeous cheeks, his broad and shining forehead, and his earlobes, which wear charming earrings. His neck is like a conch shell, his broad chest is marked with the tuft of hair called Srivatsa, and his belly with a deep navel, threefold. He has four arms, his thighs and legs are symmetrical, and he has beautiful lotus feet. He wears a spotless yellow garment, is adorned with a crown, attractive armlets and bracelets, and holds his saranga bow, discus, club, sword, conch, and rosary. He is Brahman, the absolute truth. The yogi should try to concentrate the mind until it is fixed on him alone, so that now it comes to the next stage. Meditation is the one-pointedness of mind on one image. So this is dhyanam. From dharana, dhyanam. So this dhyanam, this meditation, it's described, sometimes it's called dhruvana smriti, a continuous remembrance. There's no break. There's a little difference there between dharana and dharana and dhyana. In other words, basically, they're not a different practice, but they're a maturity of one practice. It's a deepening of the same practice. So it begins with dharana, you know, it's like a focus. It doesn't begin focused, but as you turn the hands and concentrate, it becomes focused. So dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, the three internal levels of meditation, they're called together samyana. And this chapter is going to describe the mystic benefits, the mystic powers one gets when one can do that. And it's not just you meditate on samadhi, but it's describing the process of meditation where there's a concentration and then the mind focuses until it's dharana, dhyana, where it's like you're pouring ghee or you're pouring oil, and it's just a continuous flow. So you're meditating on the object, and your consciousness is just flowing towards it and neglecting all the vrittis or other thoughts that externalize the mind. Or the difference between infancy and maturity. And so the difference is just one of degree. You're beginning to concentrate, and the concentration, the attention is intimate or distracted. Dhyana, meditation, it is unbroken and undistracted. So you begin, and you know, it takes some while to focus, so the mind is unfocused. That's dharana. You're concentrating on one object, but it's not yet steady. But as you apply your consciousness, it deepens into dhyana or meditation, and one is not, the mind flows on the object of thought without any interruption. Quote, like a smooth, even flow of oil or honey, which pours forth in one thick, uninterrupted stream. Concentration, or dharana, the previous stage, is more like the uneven trickle of water that flows in a series of distinct droplets, each one similar but uninterrupted by gaps. Hence, this sutra is distinguished from the previous one by the use of the term eka-tanata, the state meaning one image in the mind that is fixing the mind in one place. Vigyan Bhikshu states that dharana, concentration, can be disrupted. So dharana, dhyana. So the first stage of meditation is dharana. It can be disrupted. If the senses come in contact with objects that are extremely dear to the practitioner, but this does not occur in dhyana when one is fully absorbed. So in dharana, you can be allured, but in dhyana, it's very difficult to be allured because your consciousness is so absorbed that you're not aware of anything else. An example is given, just like the arrow maker, his whole being engrossed in the arrows was not aware of the king passing by his side. So you don't become aware of anything else. So that's dhyana. And then finally, there's samadhi. Samadhi is when the same dhyana shines forth as the object alone, and the mind is devoid of its own reflective nature. So here you're meditating on so there's dharana, there's a concentration, but sometimes it's disrupted. Then there is dhyana, the concentration is uninterrupted. And then you come to samadhi, where the meditation is so deep and the impressions of that object that you're meditating are so deeply imprinted on the consciousness that not only do you forget your external surroundings, but you forget yourself. There's no difference at that time between what you're meditating on, your meditation, and you yourself. There's a difference, but you become completely unaware. In other words, you forget yourself, and that's the perfection. Vyasa states that when the mind is so fully absorbed in the object of meditation that it loses all notions of self as self-conscious, reflective mind, one has reached a state of samadhi. In this state, the mind is no longer aware of itself as meditating on something external to itself. All distinctions between the yogi as a subjective meditator, the act of meditation, and the object of meditation have disappeared. So that's basically what I've covered today. Would anybody like to say hello? Or even ask a question?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Hi, Mo, Gail.
Yeah, just on this last point, do you forget yourself?
Yeah.
I was wondering how the sense of individuality is maintained.
How your sense of individuality is obtained?
Is maintained, you know, how you don't lose yourself, you know, in some kind of impersonal kind of experience. I don't know, maybe I just have to do it to understand.
I want to think about it because we know in yoga that one just becomes... Well, I guess it's the material identity, because in yoga the goal is to imbibe and want to dwell in one's own nature. One is not. It's like kind of. I guess to give the example of the sun. It's experiencing itself, not an object. So I get in this yoga, you experience yourself and not an object. So it must refer to the ego. The material conception, you forget your material conception of and I guess when you come into samadhi, it's not that there's a merging necessarily, it's how one feels. Even in the descriptions of Radha and Krishna in their love of each other, they forget themselves. They're just so absorbed. In Radha is absorbed in Krishna, Krishna is absorbed in Radha, and Radha forgets she's Radha, and Krishna forgets she's Krishna. So it seems, in this description of samadhi, there's just the object of the meditation becomes prominent, and the mind gradually dissolves. But you have to understand also that this is not, there's different schools of thought. This type of school of thought. And he's actually, he's also just describing not so much making a particular theological argument. He's just describing how the mind works. And we know that it works that way in devotion, and it works that way, and in a personal meditation too, that whatever you're meditating on, you become so absorbed in the object of meditation that you forget yourself, because it happens to the devotee too. Now the question is, does that mean that the self dissolves? No. Does that mean that one ceases to become cognizant of the self? Yes.
I understand you say that, you cease to become cognizant of the material self, but not...
Well, I guess in Radha and Krishna, the phenomena is there.
Yeah, I mean, that, I've heard of that.
And you know, there is,
I also don't understand that one either.
What's, yeah. Well, that's why that's way, way beyond when, you know, even when Ramananda Roy and Lord Chaitanya, halfway before that, it was beyond their conceptions. I guess this, in Ramananda Sambhad, when Lord Chaitanya is speaking to Ramananda Roy,
mm-hmm.
Ramananda, you know, and if you look at it, even when they begin to describe the Sarup, the nature of Radha, the nature of Krishna, you know, it's already, wow, beyond one's present experience. And then it goes further and further to that. And that's just astounding.
Isn't when they lose themselves and each other, Radha and Krishna, isn't that when we get Lord Chaitanya?
In Gaudiya Vaishnava theology, yes. But I think the point being made is, and it's made throughout the Yoga Sutras, that some of these meditations, some of these conceptions, you have to have some realization. You know, otherwise, you don't really have a frame of reference so much to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Gail.
I was just surprised to hear that, you know, that Ravana, who was always depicted as, you know, this horrible-looking demon, that he was actually attractive, something.
Okay, I put that in because generally demons are very alluring and powerful. They're you know, Diodna. Generally, the demons are described, those ones that are leaders, they have very, very alluring power. I don't know about Ravana's physical thing, but the example is given there in the purport by Ramananda Saraswati, that it was a great thing for Sita to resist his allurements. So I assume that he had some attractive feature.
Mm-hmm.
You mean when it's drawn in the paintings, he looks like a many-headed demon and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they're powerful. They're religious. They have qualities. Ravana was followed some kind of dharma. You know, so they were powerful. A lot of times, these great, when you read about these great demons, great, you know, powerful asuras, they're called, not saintly. You know, they're attractive people. Otherwise, they can't rule. That's the karma of the king. I mean, even if you see in modern days, the heirs to the king, you know, they're very handsome. You always see kings; they're very, very handsome, and they're not pious. They're not all pious souls, but generally, the rulers, the nature of that karma, to rule, that you have to have opulences, and one of the opulences is that generally the princesses are beautiful and the kings are very powerful. So Ravana was a ruler. So I assume that because it's described, it was a great thing that Sita resisted his advances, that he was attractive. But we have seen some pictures that it wasn't attractive to our eyes. That's true. Okay. Thank you, Gail.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Anybody else like to say... like to say hello today?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Thank you. Thank you, Amir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, I heard Govardhan's voice. Who's else? It was another person? Yeah. Okay, Reti. Very well. Okay. Okay, Reti, you can... Anybody else? Seems it's our steady group today. Reti, you can send me the figures and, you know, who's on the class, how many people. Okay, thank you all. I did hear someone told me this too today, that the reason I have the class at 9 o'clock is because that's when most cell phones are free. But people tell me that these days it probably doesn't matter so much. So when I decide to finish the Yoga Sutras, I may not do the whole thing, depending on how relevant it is. I may opt for moving the class up an hour, but I'm willing to take people's feedback, because sometimes when it comes to the end of the day at this time, I'm afraid I'm going to fall asleep on the phone. Not always, but some days. Okay, thank you all so much. Okay. Okay, thank you. Vanchakalpa Rubius Chakrapa Sindhu Vachapati Nampa.